has to be explored. One of the things we're talking about.
We have 10 seconds, Bishop.
We're talking about getting some public policy experts and doctors to help do that analysis so that people know really what's going on and we can fight to change it.
Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign and Repairers of the Breach, speaking to us from Jackson, Mississippi, headed to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we will continue to cover both of these issues. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM. And at 107.3 FM, as well as over the internet, via WUSB.FM. And all of our programs are archived. It's now just about 6 o'clock on a Tuesday, time for another edition of Off the Wall. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall, Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. I'm joined tonight by a laughing Kyle. Something funny, Kyle?
No,
what is it that amuses you so?
I'm amused at my own hearing perceptions. Because when I hear the clunking of the strings, it starts sounding like one of those twangy, I think it's a mouth harp.
I don't think Philip Glass wrote this piece for your amusement.
No. But I'll find out what the instrument is. But like a thumb piano or something, it sounds... I don't know if I'm hearing two notes at the same time, or maybe I just need to clean my ears.
I would always suggest that, and who knows what you're hearing.
I just know that instrument that I'm thinking of is not in this. I'm just hearing it as different
notes. Don't ruin it for me. I don't want to hear instruments that aren't there. Wow.
I'm having a great afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. Oh, do you feel that? Do you feel it? Spring is in the air. I was outside before... And it's just, there's that magical feeling that you only get at this time of year. Soon the flowers will be coming out, and they'll start playing baseball, and
it's
all
like,
kinds of cool things.
Yeah, this transition, this new beginning. It's just everything is bright and fresh.
Yeah, I get that. It's just a very refreshing type of feeling in the wind, you know, and it's... Yeah, I know it's September. But it feels like spring. I don't know why. I guess autumn kind of feels like spring, but there's something different about today. Today felt like spring. So I don't know what's going on.
Well, the only, I think, distinction is that what you're looking towards after. It's much warmer after spring, but after...
No, I don't like that.
After autumn, you're looking to something much colder, so you're sort of descending into this, the depths of this storm and the cold... thrusts of nature, and maybe you get to spring.
No, that's what I like. I like looking forward to the cold and the dark.
Oh, yeah.
And I prefer autumn. So today wasn't a good day for me because it felt like spring. I'm not sure I'm explaining it clearly enough. But, it's just we have bizarre weather here. But we haven't had a hurricane, not yet, not here. But, boy, it's all of a sudden hurricanes are in the news. Fiona, we had some remnants of Fiona with the wind and the rain. But it really hit, apart from Puerto Rico, it really hit in the Maritimes in Canada.
Sure did.
Yeah, we've been glued to the TV because we get Canadian TV, and we're just watching how people are being rescued. Portobosque, which is a city on the southwestern part of Newfoundland, it's where the ferry from Nova Scotia docks. They were devastated. They were literally, I think, 40 homes swept into the sea. They said a multi-level apartment building swept into the sea as well. Fortunately, not a huge number of casualties. I think maybe one person was killed total in Newfoundland. I think there's one person in Nova Scotia was killed, one person in Prince Edward Island. But they were hit hard, harder than any other storm ever. That's that kind of history. You barely hear about it in American media, but it's right next door, and it could have been us easily.
Certainly could, and they're relying on so many different people from around the area and, of course, down south to get help, but our hearts go out to everyone who's suffering up there, and it is remarkable, because that's with warning.
Yeah.
Imagine without any warning, like there's no satellite, no forecast, you just have to kind of judge it in your gut, and then maybe run in the right direction.
Well, fortunately, I don't think very many of us have to do that. Unless you just got hit by a hurricane, I guess you wouldn't know when the next one was coming.
Right, but I'm just saying with, you know, some advanced knowledge, some people were able to get out the way. But how do you protect against that with coastal, like, erosion? And really what it is the sea level, the surge, I guess, is that really critical component. It's not necessarily winds.
I get what you're saying, because people paid attention to what they were hearing over the media, rather than massing in the streets and saying it's all a bunch of fake news and we shouldn't trust the media or anything government tells us to do and we should just be on our own and embrace our ignorance. You're basically saying they didn't do that and glory to them for not doing that. Good point, Kyle.
That is the subtext.
Good point, yes.
Yeah.
If you listen, maybe you'll gain something. And in this particular case, most people listened. But it doesn't change the fact that virtually all of Nova Scotia is still without power. we haven't heard from the raccoon whisperer. We don't know what's going on up there.
Yeah, that's a dire, dire situation. I think that's sort of what I meant is they need all the technical expertise. Mm-hmm. Same stuff we worry about around Stony Brook. And whenever there's a big crisis with power outages and stuff, you get crews from all over.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really all hands. You know, anybody can help who's, you know, available and able. And the more people that get back online, the more they're able to help their neighbors and other folks.
Absolutely.
Or provide services for people from adjacent areas that may not have any of that yet.
You know, you can hop on the Internet, hop onto YouTube and just type either CBC or CTV, and you'll see all kinds of news reports about what's going on up there. It's next door to us. It's not that far away, and it's something that we really should be aware of, and there are ways that we can help as well. There's one program that airs every night on CBC, I think at 10 o'clock, called The National. It's their one-hour-long national broadcast. I wish they aired that in this country, but I don't think there's a single channel anywhere in the United States that airs The National. It's just a really good summation of both events in North America and around the world. And, you know, they get our news, no problem there. We should be able to get that. So if there's any TV channel out there looking for an hour to fill, you know, this would be a good PBS. Maybe you could do that.
It's a great window into it. And those public broadcasting relationships, just like we do with community radio, we air Democracy Now! We air all kinds of content that you might not be able to hear elsewhere. There's plenty of outlets. It's just about getting that audience aware of where they can find it and getting them kind of interested. But that program is particularly, or just something like that for a brief amount of time in a foreign market, it can go a long way. Because I just find that glimpse is really rewarding, just being able to know what's going on and get mm-hmm. kind of the humor and the attitudes and what's important to people so close to you. There's so many storms, though. There's, like, Puerto Rico. There's all kinds of different stuff going on.
Remember when Peter Mansbridge used to host The National?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't remember a time when he
gigantic forehead? No? Well, he hasn't in a while.
I know. Trying to block that out, but...
No,
yeah.
He was great. He was like their Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, no, he was the voice of, when I first really got into watching CBC a little bit, because I did get one of those channels on a cable provider.
That's right. You grew up in Washington State, and you had one of the few cable providers that actually provided a CBC station.
Yeah, it was 99 or something. I think that was the channel.
Uh-huh.
That's what's great, though. It gets you a little bit of a insight, and I hope there's more outreach and more reciprocation among those TV markets, and because there's so much content out there, and so many of us are aware of what's going on. It's great to hear how people are reporting it and be able to compare it to the kind of news gathering, and that way you can compare and have a little bit of a perspective on you know what is being portrayed and how it's framed, and that way I think you become a more critical consumer of media.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, one thing about The National, they always have this thing called The Moment at the end of the show. It's always on tonight's moment, and it's something significant that struck people that they just want to focus upon just for, you know, a minute or two. And last night, they were focusing on this 4-year-old kid who went missing in Nova Scotia right after the storm. His parents were cleaning up, and he somehow wandered off into the woods. They couldn't find him for 15 hours. Can you imagine the torture? And just focusing on that moment when he was found safely, that's something the whole nation can identify with. And I think it's something we can identify with, too. So you can probably find that online. I'm sure it's available, cbc.ca. They probably have it there every night, just like Democracy Now! Is available at democracynow.org.
Wow, yeah, I didn't know that they had a video of it or they portrayed it like that, but yeah, you get a lot out of those human interest things. I think we think of it as like your feel-good, you know, end-of-the-hour story, but yeah, it just gives you a little bit of happiness, a little bit of that joy.
Well, it's not always joy, though. It can be a, you know, a sad moment.
But certainly, but like a little bit of something that touches the heart, you know, I think No Comment is like that, too, on
your news, yes, Euronews. Which we do get here in, at least on Optimum. They're good enough to carry that channel on, I think, Channel 103. So that's, yeah, okay, well, enough talk about other media.
We're fond of that
yeah.
market, the Canadian stuff.
Well, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to you know, every CBC station has call letters that they don't use, but they have them. Like, for instance, CBC in Montreal, CBM. I know this because when I was a kid, I would be listening to my AM radio, and occasionally I'd pick up Canada, and they would identify the stations then. So CBM, I remember, was Montreal. CBH was Halifax. And, in fact, CBH radio, which you can get on TuneIn or various other apps, they were doing some great radio over the weekend because nobody had power in Nova Scotia. But so they were taking calls from people all around the area, people who are listening on battery-powered radios or hand-cranked radios. I want to get one of those. I've never seen a hand-cranked radio. But, I mean, you never run out of power as long as you can crank the radio, right?
Yeah, every time you need it, you start looking at your radio, your portable equipment, and you realize, wow, I should really invest in, you know, something a little bit better or something, you know, maybe I could use a couple of these, or where can I hook up a solar panel to it,
yeah.
or something, you know,
this
a little
where,
bit more sincere than this cruddy boombox that I'm relying
on. This is where radio shines. This is where you cannot replace it with some pre-programmed playlist or a network feed or something like that. Local radio matters. And in this particular case, it wasn't even that local. CBH covers all of Nova Scotia. In fact, a good part of the Maritimes. And they lost power at one point, too. And the station in Moncton, which is in New Brunswick, had to step in. It was like 5 seconds of dead air. And they took over from there. But the important thing is to give people a voice where they can use their phones. Landlines, by the way, because the cell service went out really quickly. So they use landlines to call in and share their experiences. It is so therapeutic. I've heard this many, many times in various places in times of emergency where people really need to communicate. And radio fosters that.
Yeah, it was so fascinating to see it operate as a community bulletin board and a way to spread information person to person or person to everyone. And just like a more serious version of just taking calls for fun.
Right.
They were going through people who had something to say, who wanted to talk about the conditions, their experience, which you said is incredibly cathartic. But there was also the appreciation for the medium.
Yes.
Appreciating the people that were doing the work to answer those calls and get the conversation out there and keep everything up and running so that they could have a hub to get information from themselves.
Just
there was acknowledgement.
The dedication to get to the station so that they could take those calls. And I've seen that same dedication with people at WUSB in the middle of a hurricane
or it's familiar.
A blizzard. Got to get to the station and hopefully serve as a forum for people to call in, share their experiences and things like that. I know right now we're at super reduced power still, like only 20%. We're working on it. We're working on getting back up there. It's going to happen.
It's intentional.
Yes. Yeah, so please help support the station so that we can get through these crises. Our transmitter blew up last, seems like a long time ago, but it was old. It was very, very old. And these things happen. Yeah, so Canadian. Oh, yeah, and by the way, speaking of call letters, Toronto, CBL. I don't know why. They're not CBT, they're CBL. Yeah, that's a mystery I've been wondering about since I was a kid. But I don't think I ever figured that one out. Yeah, another hurricane, Hurricane Ian. Whoever named the hurricanes this year, I think, is a Shameless fan because if you watch that show, there's a Fiona, there's an Ian, and there's a Carl. And there's a Carl coming. Carl with a K. I don't know if the one on the show began with a C or a K. It doesn't matter. You can't really tell or prove it. So that's three of the kids named in this year's hurricane season. So that's something kind of bizarre. Imagine if it was, you know, Peter, Greg, and Bobby. You know, you'd say, oh, wow, that person's a Brady Bunch fan. Yeah, or Jan, or Marcia, or Cindy. I know all the Brady Bunch kid names. Wow, I know them. I know them fast, too. I didn't even... Okay, hold on. Alice was the maid. Carol was the mom, and... Oh, Who did Robert Reed play? What was his name? What was the Brady dad's name? I blocked that one out.
Tom. No,
that no, it wasn't Tom
player.
Brady. My God. I guess I'll never know.
Was it Ed Brady? No.
I want to say Ralph, but that's wrong.
Ralph Brady?
Ralph Brady doesn't sound right.
Ed or...
It's
Fred? It's, what am I thinking?
No, that's Fred Sanford.
I don't know.
Fred Sanford, that's who that is.
That's such a specific thing. I mean, that's just the Brady Bunch dad, right? Like, I guess I'm not a super fan. Not the way I thought.
Well, I mean, I got everybody else really quickly.
I'm impressed at that.
Didn't they have a dog, too? I think they had a dog.
This is Marsha.
That's nasty, Kyle.
Marsha.
You just called Marsha a dog?
No.
Why would you do that?
Wow, I'm really not a super fan.
This is the 1990s.
No, I was just naming a name. I wasn't answering your question. Answering your question, the dog, no, don't know the dog's name.
Anyway, let's get to important things. Because some might argue this is not important at all.
Stop arguing.
Ian is on his way somewhere, and right now it looks like he's got Florida in his sights. And boy, I'm worried about this one. I'm worried about Tampa, because I think what we're seeing here is the potential for a Katrina-style hurricane hitting Tampa and just having massive flooding of a sort that they have never seen. I don't think they've been hit with a hurricane since the 1920s, 100 years ago. And whether or not they're prepared, that's going to be interesting to see. It's also going to be interesting to see politically, because a situation like this can make or break a governor. And, of course, as we all know, Ron DeSantis has been in the headlines for a number of reasons. Well, it's about to be another reason, whether he handles the hurricane well or whether he completely screws up.
Is he a hurricane denier?
No, not yet. Not yet. He has not really been appearing much in public, so take that for what it's worth. But the real question is, will people get help as quickly as possible? I know the federal government already declared them a disaster area, and that wasn't, you know, out of spite or anything like that. No, they declared preemptively declared them a disaster area because it's pretty obvious it's going to hit and affect the entire state. And nobody wants any delays in getting the help that's needed. In fact, I believe DeSantis even praised Biden at one point, which is kind of unheard of. But then Biden is only talking to the mayors of the affected communities so far. I don't know if he's talked directly to DeSantis. I'm not sure what the rationale is either way on that one, if someone's not taking someone's calls, or I don't know. I don't think anybody really is in the mood for that kind of nonsense.
We can only assume there's preparation and coordination that's ongoing as we speak, right?
And then there's also the candidate, Chris, who's running against DeSantis, former Republican governor, in fact, now a Democrat. How does he handle it? How does he react? Does he overstep in any way? Is he somebody who's able to basically interact with people? It's going to be interesting. This next week is really going to, I think, sway a lot of people one way or another. But, of course, all that pales in comparison to what the people are going to actually be experiencing. And, again, you know, I'm worried about that particular region because the latest, and I just looked at the maps right before the show, looks like it's heading right for Tampa. It could be up to a Category 4, although the category really doesn't matter at this point. It's the fact that the storm is going to stall in the Gulf of Mexico for a little while, and it's going to be something like a 48-hour event as opposed to usually hurricanes are through in about 6 hours. So that, they're talking about over 20 inches of rain, maybe even more than that, you know, like 25 or even 30. It's just something that for a place as flat as Florida, it could be devastating. It could really be devastating. So we'll certainly be focusing on that. If you know people down there, definitely give them a call and see how they're doing. Make sure they're doing the right things, taking it seriously, not denying the hurricanes or the media or anything like that. And then, of course, you know, it might head up this way. Who knows? By next week, we might have a little storm or we might have another storm.
Remnants certainly will be inland. There's all kinds of effects
Yeah, I mean,
on the periphery of
Hurricane Frank Gallagher could make a beeline for Long Island, and who knows? Who knows what that will bring?
So check the batteries in your boombox.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, if you're in the area, get out of the way. You know, things like that. We're here with all of the common sense tips. And, you know, go ahead, ask me about anything. I can tell you exactly what you have to do in the storm. I got it right here, all in the noggin.
You went running outside in a thunderstorm yesterday, or 2 days ago. Are you the person to ask?
What does that have to do with
you? You were just
anything?
Running around saying, oh, it's raining, and, you know, challenging God. Okay. I you know, is that the example you want to set for the children?
I don't understand why you're questioning my judgment. Perhaps I was communicating with it.
It was a good thunderstorm. It was a welcome thunderstorm. I enjoyed it myself. In fact, there was a tornado out in Matatuck, I heard. But that's out east. Who cares about out east, right?
Watch the weather. I don't know. I care. I care. I greatly care about all directions.
Well, I got a couple of things, a couple of updates, which I think are interesting. This is a New York Times story that came out yesterday. And a lot of these political campaigns are fascinating to watch. This is a guy named Mastriano. Have you heard of Mastriano?
Wait, yeah.
It's a good Doug Mastriano.
Maybe, yeah.
I just like saying it. Doug Mastriano. He is running for governor of Pennsylvania. Yeah. In the same spot, this is from the New York Times, in the same spot where he spoke to thousands of people at a raucous state capitol rally demanding an end to pandemic restrictions in April 2020, Doug Mastriano appeared on Saturday before a crowd of just a few dozen, about half of whom were volunteers for his ragtag campaign for governor of Pennsylvania. Mr. Mastriano, an insurgent state senator who in the spring cruised to the Republican nomination, is learning this fall that while it is one thing to win a crowded GOP primary on the back of online fame and Donald Trump's endorsement, it's quite another to prevail in the general election in a battleground state of nearly 13 million people. He's being heavily outspent by his Democratic rival, has had no television ads on the air since May, has chosen not to interact with the state's news media in ways that would push his agenda, and trails by double digits in reputable public polling and most private surveys. And there's no sign of the cavalry coming to his aid either. The Republican Governors Association, which is helping the party's nominees in Arizona, Michigan, and six other states, has no current plans to assist Mr. Mastriano. That's according to people with knowledge of its deliberations. And the particular race, the Pennsylvania governor's race, is perhaps the most consequential in the country. Mr. Mastriano, retired Army colonel who chartered buses to the January 6, 2021 rally that led to the attack on the Capitol, has vowed to ban abortion without exceptions and pledged to enact sweeping new voting restrictions. And he would be likely to accomplish all of that, given the Republican advantage in the state legislature. But I don't think people are that enthusiastic about that agenda. In fact, I'm seeing that around the country where people are reacting against what Republicans are accomplishing. And nothing could be better. This is something that even Democrats could not accomplish on their own. The Republicans had to do this for us. And I don't mean that I'm part of the Democrats. I don't consider myself that. But I do consider myself somebody who stands up against all of the nonsense that we've been seeing lately with Republican agendas.
I've been hearing a lot of that, a lot of disassociating from just what that party label has come to mean. Folks that just really, you know, I don't question it. Whatever, if that's something that they were a part of and they think that there's a better direction, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm.
I still have serious trust issues across the board, but, you know, from within, from, you know, all over in party politics and,
right,
and politics in general. But the thing we need to reiterate is that, you know, this is a system we have. We got to make sure it functions and you know, perhaps we get something done and agree on some stuff along the way. But those foundational things, I think, really got a lot of people's attention.
Yeah, they sure did.
They enjoy stability. You know, people want to just, you know, get on with their lives, the kitchen table issues, all that stuff. they go, they'll vote if they can, you know, if you're not preventing people from doing it. But it's, yeah, I think a sentiment of just not wanting to wear that label. There's a lot of talk of independence. I don't care. I mean, again, the party labels, it's their vehicles for the people to have representation and work done on legislation, and I can only hope. I hope it's just more back to that kind of business. And as far as spending, I mean, by the bar, if that's the name of the game, like you were talking about a couple months ago, I think it's critical. Buy all the ads. It's ridiculous. Let them spend money on lawyers chasing, you know, fake electors or whatever scheme they want to do instead of putting forth a platform and getting votes to back it up, you know, and then getting to work.
Well, you know, I've never considered myself to be a member of any party. I'm just not comfortable with those kind of labels. That's why I've always been not part of the Independence Party or anything like that. Independent, just independent, not affiliated with anybody. But lately, you know, it's impossible to be aligned with anything remotely Republican because of what they have done. You know, I haven't changed. I don't think I have, but what they certainly have changed. So, you know, when I seem to be espousing the Democratic platform, capital D Democratic, it's because Republicans have pretty much eliminated any possibility of being taken seriously. So that's not something that I wanted to see. You know, I voted for Republicans in the past when they made sense. Haven't done that in a long time because they're not making sense, or at least not making sense, you know, for somebody who values democracy. Making sense for the more authoritarian among us, perhaps, but it's not something that I can easily accept under any circumstances. So don't mistake me for a Democrat, but, you know, there's no other choice at the moment. There really isn't, and that's sad. There should be lots of choices. There should be lots of directions we can go in, but when one party has been torn apart like the Republicans have, you just can't turn a blind eye to that.
It's the principles. It's, you know, do we all want to have a deliberative government where it's not about force and corruption? Those are the things we should be concerned about. You know, we should be getting it right, getting things functional. But yeah, I don't know. I've been hearing a lot of different labels. You know, I guess born again libertarians that are out there. There's some unaffiliated. There's whatever people have to get away from.
Be yourself. You don't have to have you don't have to have a label attached to who you are. The thing that annoys me though is that I have no say in primaries. Unlike some states where you can vote in whatever primary you wish, I don't get any choice until election day. That doesn't seem fair at all. If you're going to, you know, whittle it down to a particular candidate out of many, everybody should be involved in that from the beginning. The whole party system just annoys me for that reason.
I just like to see all the crazy names. So.
Well, yeah, you certainly get a lot out in Washington, that's for sure. And California, boy, like 100 people running for mayor. Yeah, it can be funny, but you also got to be careful that you don't open the door for somebody who's a true threat.
Yeah, and I think it's this delay with some of the candidates that they were so afraid, they're working out of fear and align themselves with something so foul that now when there isn't as much of an appetite for that foulness, their choices, their alignments are still based on this calculation that was mostly fear. And people are a bit more fed up than afraid, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, what's there to be afraid of exactly?
Good question.
Yeah, I mean, this fear of immigrants is just ridiculous. Well, and it's something that's fostered by, you know, the backwards governors of places like Florida and Texas and Arizona. I wonder, you know, when this hurricane hits, how many people will be helping to dig everybody out and to restore everything to normal? How many of those people do you think are immigrants? You know, imagine if none of them pitched in. I would suspect the majority will be pitching in, and maybe they won't realize the value. They won't. But I mean, imagine a scenario where okay, you don't like immigrants, then immigrants can't stay in Florida, can't stay in Texas. I'll go all the other states that welcome them, and Florida and Texas, you got to do it all on your own without the help of any immigrants whatsoever. How long do you think they would last? I really would. I would enjoy seeing that for a few days until it got unbearable. The ignorance is just, how much of it can we possibly take? And people are embracing it. In Texas, we talked about this. Beto O'Rourke is falling further behind Greg Abbott because of what he's doing to immigrants. It's awful. At some point, you have to blame the people.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. I don't really, I don't know how trustworthy a lot of that stuff is. I hope it goes better there.
Maybe the polls are wrong, but don't forget, Greg Abbott is also anti-abortion. He's taking away the rights of women. You can't embrace something like that because it's going to come to a point where you can't even vote him out anymore.
Yeah, it seems like there's a hunger for some change there, but we'll continue to see, and I think that places like that and those attitudes, taking it out on minorities and misplacing a lot of this anger, mm-hmm. and telling outright lies about people who are basically right next to you in the voting booth,
yeah,
is really insulting our intelligence, and I just zero patience for that anymore. So again, yeah. trust is earned.
When your platform basically focuses on hatred of other people who look different from you, you're going down the wrong road. There's just no other way to look at that. And I'm sorry if you don't see that. Beto O'Rourke turned 50 yesterday. How is that guy 50? He looks like he's 25. It's just so youthful, and he's 50.
Well, I don't know. We're in a different age.
Maybe 50 is a new 30. I don't know, but I was surprised to read that.
We're in a different age. There's all kinds of things that we thought were one way that aren't necessarily the same, especially with regards to health. I hope that we all have as much vitality and can stand on bars or whatever Beto's doing down there. I just know that he's in, like, different places. He's just, like, touring around and talking to everybody, so
He's found the high-speed rail somehow because he's getting from one part of Texas to another really quickly.
Yeah, he seems pretty amazing. Like, I don't think he's in two places at once yet, but it's interesting to watch.
Interesting story in Newsday yesterday. While progressive insurgents have racked up wins against party-backed Democrats in recent years, the tide has receded this year as both groups face a shared target in Republicans hoping to stage a conservative comeback. This pattern is highlighted by several wins by party-backed establishment candidates in this summer's Democratic primaries, as well as a lack of new progressive candidates threatening to siphon votes from Democrats or Democratic nominees on November ballot. It comes as Republican challengers threaten core Democratic values, including abortion rights, gun control. That's according to political analysts. There is a common enemy that drives Democrats back together, said Gerald Benjamin, a distinguished professor of political science at SUNY New Paltz. We've seen that. We've seen progressives who are challenging Democrats, including 2018 when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez upset Representative Joe Crowley, who had served in Congress since 1999. The pure progressives on the woke left, as they are sometimes called, have grown as a factor in Democratic primaries. But what's happening this year is that I think people are seeing the threat, the really important threat that needs to be taken seriously. For instance, let's look at the governor's race. Kathy Hochul, she defeated New York City public advocate Jamon Williams, who is a progressive leader, 67% to 20%. Yeah. Williams' running mate for the lieutenant governor's nomination, activist Anna Maria Arquila, lost to Hochul's running mate, Representative Antonio Delgado, 60% to 25%. And in a heated congressional race in the Hudson Valley, Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, a leading Democrat in Congress, defeated State Senator Alessandra Biaggi, who was a leading progressive leader in Albany, 70% to 29%. These are huge numbers. It's a huge margin of victory. So I think what progressives are doing wisely at this point is backing off a bit and throwing support behind the more mainstream candidates, because that is a realistic opportunity to defeat Republican challengers or even Republican incumbents. Now, you know, we look back at 2016, when progressives assumed Clinton was going to win, and supporters of progressive Bernie Sanders didn't show up in force at the polls to vote for Hillary Clinton. Big mistake. Big mistake. That helped Donald Trump win. And I think it's a lesson that we've all learned now. I mean, some of us learned it in 2000 when we got Bush over Gore by the thinnest of margins. But to have that happen in 2016 was a real blow. And I think, you know, what we're finally starting to realize, what we talked about on this show for years, is that sometimes you have to take a tiny step in order to take a big step. And winning Democratic control in as many places as possible, it actually is a pretty big step, but it's not as big a step as many of us want to take. Yeah, we want it all. We want the progressive agenda, but we're not going to get the progressive agenda by losing. That's just a fact. And right now, it just doesn't have as much support as needed to win outright. But if you get Democratic leaders in positions of power, that progressive agenda becomes more obtainable over time. We have to be patient. And right now, there are so many threats to our democracy that have to be defeated. And if they're not, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're progressive or mainstream. Everyone's going to be in the minority, whether or not you're in the majority, because that is how the system can be manipulated, so that even if you're in the majority, you could still lose.
Yeah, I think just getting the numbers up as far as, you know, as many people engaged, active, talking about the issues, talking about what's really going on with the right issues, instead of mischaracterizations and talking about, like, an entire party and the sort of fringe or most idealistic elements of it being thrust forward into the discourse as though that is the entirety of that particular party. I don't think that was true. It definitely got people excited, and I think was reinvigorating and a point of interest for the party. But certainly there are much more moderate voters in there. But new voters were excited about these issues, and they are prescient. They are just as important when you're assuming perhaps a more functional institution. But there have been a lot of more pressing issues. There have been a lot of conflicts and economic woes and a variety of pitfalls over the years that have prevented some of the attention on issues that really truly have suffered and been put on way back burner for quite a long time. And these losses recently, I think, are just reminders of how you have to stay on it and continue to get engagement and get voters out there. Because the other thing about that is, like, okay, yeah, maybe the old school, more moderate side of the left is, you know, they don't have the numbers, or they may not have the excitement about some of the current day issues, and they don't see them in the same way as younger voters. But now there are even more young voters,
yeah,
who have just registered. And I think that the lesson or the thing that can be taught is just basically what you said, that yes, that this is, you know, not a monolith in and of itself. There are really strong aspirational things. There are things that have been put on back burner that have not got the attention. There are plenty of problems with issues and critiques to go around. But, you know, the way we have success is by having that broader appeal and following through with a platform that impacts people in a wide way, but also follows through, is a success in and of itself. You know, it provides.
Yeah, I think the excitement is here. I think people are waking up and realizing, wow, they're really going to do the things that were worst-case scenario if we let them. And unlike any midterm election that I can recall, I think people are really motivated to get out there and fight back against that. Kansas, you know, was a great example of that, where people turned out in droves to ensure that abortion remained a right in Kansas. If it can happen there, it can happen in virtually any state. And that is the kind of thing that I really hope people remember, that they have power, that they need to exercise that power, and that this November is coming up pretty soon. People need to turn out in large numbers and voice their opinion loudly, and don't let yourself be denied, because believe me, they are trying. They are trying to do that as much as possible through the courts, through ridiculous legislation, through fear and suspicion, and brute force if necessary. This is all right at our doorstep now. And we see so many instances of this. It's, you know, it's something to watch. It's something to see all the problems Trump has gotten himself into, you know, through his own idiocy, and to see how we fight back, and to see how we don't get immediate satisfaction, but it really kind of feels like we're getting somewhere. Now, I know there's another hearing. The January 6th Commission was scheduled for tomorrow. It's been postponed because of the hurricane. Yep, unfortunately.
Is it testifying?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly. It was a daytime hearing, but it won't be happening tomorrow because of the hurricane approaching Florida. But it will happen. It will happen fairly soon. Here's a story that I thought was kind of interesting. It comes from The Guardian. I'll just read you the headline. Texas Attorney General ran from home to avoid abortion subpoena. Let's just see what in God's name this is about. The Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton ran out of his house and jumped into a truck driven by his wife, a state senator, to avoid being served a subpoena to testify today in an abortion access case. That's according to court documents. A process server wrote in an affidavit that he was attempting to deliver the federal court subpoena Monday at Paxton's home and ultimately had to leave the document on the ground. He said the Republican avoided him for more than an hour from inside his house, then dashed toward the truck, and the couple drove off. Paxton's facing a variety of legal troubles. That's what Republican isn't. As he seeks to win a third term in November, he said he avoided the server out of safety concerns and that the news media should be ashamed for reporting on what happened. Yeah, news media, how dare you report the facts of what happened here? It's clear that the media wants to drum up another controversy involving my work as Attorney General, so they're attacking me for having the audacity to avoid a stranger lingering outside my home and showing concern about the safety and well-being of my family. Oh, please. You were in there for an hour, all right? I'm pretty sure that's enough time to figure out who's on your front line. Had your wife get into the truck. She was outside already. So between the two of you, you had the guy surrounded. You could have easily found out what he was doing, but I think you knew what he was doing. He probably had the piece of paper in his hands. You know, it's really nobody's believing it, Tom. Nobody.
I've actually done legal messaging and process service, and I'm going to say that's good. He got it.
I'm sorry, I called him Tom. His name is Ken.
That is a
Tom Paxton.
He got served. That's it. Like that is, to me, in my opinion, that's complete. I mean, the server went to the door, notified someone there, got her name, stated clearly what he was doing or why he was there. Then the whole fiasco with the truck, them seeing him, him being able to talk through the window of a truck, even if the window's closed, I don't know, that's even like further, you know, showing them the documents. It's not like you need to even hear at that point because you're visually able to see. And whatever safety concern, okay, you have the car window.
I'm looking at the Dallas News now. This gets even worse. This gets even worse because after fleeing his home with his wife to avoid being served with a subpoena the day before, today Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said the process server is lucky this situation did not escalate further or necessitate force. He's threatening the guy now. He's threatening the guy with violence. He said in a statement that he fled his home because a strange man came onto my property at home, yelled unintelligibly, and charged toward me. I perceived the person to be a threat because he was neither honest nor upfront about his intentions. Citing the hazards of his job, he continued, in light of the constant threats against me, for which dangerous individuals are currently incarcerated, I take a number of common sense precautions for me and my family's safety when I'm at home. Texans do the same to protect themselves from threats, and many also exercise their Second Amendment rights to protect themselves and their families. He's threatening to kill the guy for serving him. I'm sorry, but, you know, I wasn't there, but I pretty much think, you know, the process serving routine has been established, and it's not hard to figure out that you're being served. And I think he knew what was going on the whole time. You know, it's an hour, his wife outside in the truck already.
Apparently, the server showed him the envelope and the papers, and then it was left leaning on the vehicle and then in the driveway after they left. But ridiculous. Yeah, you know what? The person stated, the first thing they said probably is, I'm a messenger of the court, you know, that I'm there on behalf of this legal proceedings, and you know, to say that you were being shouted at, that maybe it was because you were being combative and barricading yourself.
Probably, you know, to talk through a door, you probably have to raise your voice a little bit to say what, and unintelligible, not sure what that means. You know, the guy had an accent, is that what it is? Who knows? But it doesn't make any sense that the process server would try and make himself into a dangerous threat. He's not going to get his job done that way. But it makes perfect sense that this Ken Paxton character would try and make this into some sort of plot against him and make it as dramatic as possible and then threaten the guy with violence. I mean, God, how repulsive is that?
Yeah, and on top of this legal challenge, then, oh, what? He's going to have an assault or some kind of charge after having committed some act against a process server? It's not going to really help your legal stance there, bud.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So that's a little bit what's going on in the political realm. And as you can see, Republicans are just up to it all over again, fighting the media, fighting the people, fighting democracy. Okay, we only have a few minutes left. So I wanted to focus on this story about cannabis entrepreneurs on Long Island who want to open up dispensaries already. And they're being frustrated by all kinds of zoning legislations that are restricting operators to industrial areas. This is really bad. This is terrible, what they are doing in so many places. Dispensaries can open only in Long Island towns that opted in to retail marijuana sales, and there's relatively few of those. We're in one of them. Brookhaven is one of them. Southampton is another. I believe Riverhead is a third. In three of the four opt-in municipalities, legislation has been adopted or proposed that would keep the dispensaries out of downtowns and put them in isolated zones or commercial locations. Okay, so what you do when you do something like that, you pretty much eliminate the possibility of anybody who is a small business from being able to operate, because you have to be able to have a massive space somewhere far away from where people actually congregate. It's much more open to the big corporate entrepreneurs.
It does make a difference, these zoning requirements. The kinds of things you'd have to do to make yourself functional in that environment really eliminate certain types of business. Like, I think you're talking about specifically is foot traffic. If you're in an industrial area, there's not going to be. Now, there's caveats. You know, there are interesting businesses that have cropped up, and many times, if it's successful, these areas could have some kind of coffee shop or other things grow over time around it. That's very idealistic, though. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. The practicality is you are thrusting these new entrepreneurs that should get a fair shake at this. They're getting a little bit of a head start over other applicants and so forth. And the startup costs and logistics of bringing this stuff to market are themselves pretty daunting. So long story short, I think things like online sales with pickup in these areas, you know, you have to become like a warehouse or some kind of distribution point.
It's
I don't know.
It's a more difficult. It's more advanced.
That then means you have to have a really functional e-commerce department. You can't just be a mom and pop shop that is getting foot traffic. So those types of things constrain.
Look, this is what Brookhaven approved a year ago in August 2021, a zoning amendment that banned pot sales within 500 feet of homes, 1,000 feet of schools, houses of worship, hospitals, libraries, parks, playgrounds, gyms, dance studios, or at common gathering places. And each store has to be at least 1 mile apart. It was approved 6-0 by the town board. Look, town board, what is it you're afraid of exactly? I mean, 1,000 feet away from schools and dance studios and gym. I mean, what do you think is going to be happening? First of all, let's just address the issue of schools. All right, if you have a dispensary, do you think they're going to let children in? No, they're going to keep children out. In fact, you're going to be a lot more secure having a dispensary downtown because kids won't be able to buy pot downtown. However, you don't have a dispensary downtown, kids will be able to buy pot in the alleyways because that's the only thing they can possibly do. Yeah. And you know, it's just a ridiculous... It's just fear. It's nonsense.
Unless the kids are selling, then...
Now, I don't mean kids are going out buying pot. I'm just saying you're driving them in that direction. You're driving the entire town into that nefarious alleyway again.
Well, in seriousness, it's a list of things that our communities are chock full of. I mean, those are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay... Show us the map, technically, with those radius, you know, whatever distances. What does that actually leave entrepreneurs, people that are starting these businesses up? What is that? What choice does that give them? What is left? And I don't know. Has anybody created resources for those business owners? What areas is there property for sale? You know, is it actually viable?
It's almost
under
impossible to find something that fits all that criteria. It's almost impossible. And, you know, we don't have these concerns over bars. We don't have these concerns over stores that sell cigarettes or any kind of other thing that kids should not have access to. You know, but what's the deal with houses of worship? Why can't a dispensary be right next door to a house of worship? What is it going to do? How is it going to affect them adversely? This is just fear and ignorance, all right? I've been to a few dispensaries in various parts of the country, actually a couple of countries.
Been to a bunch.
And you'd be amazed how professional and how articulate people are there and the clientele. You know, it's a positive experience, not anything shady or unhealthy. And... you know, you don't see kids anywhere near the place, and that's how it should be. And you basically ensure that if you have that presence. When you don't have that presence, you're basically opening it up to the way it used to be, and just saying, yeah, let's make it illegal, let's make it shady, let's make it so that, you know, it's not something that we do in this town, which is just it's just wrong.
Yeah, what you do see is a lot of adults getting in, getting out, and then, you know, going home and making dinner, you know, getting on with their lives.
Yeah, right, exactly. Try it out. Look, at least have one town try it a different way so that you can see what happens. Or look at other states. Look at Massachusetts. Look at Illinois, even. And look at Canada.
That's a good point. The people in these areas that are making these decisions should have at least visited one other municipality that has done this to get a sense.
Yes, I'll drive. Just do that. Go to a dispensary in Massachusetts and see how they do things there.
You don't have to consume anything, but check it out. See what works.
Hey, we're out of time. Finn is up next. This week, the season ender for Reservation Dogs. So if you haven't watched that program about Native Americans in Oklahoma, please, two seasons. It's on Hulu, I think. Just track it down. And you won't regret it. It's been renewed, too. Three seasons, so.
Oh, that's rad.
That's awesome.
Good end.
I think it's our favorite show right now.
It is.
And we only learned about it by traveling across the country and stopping in Oklahoma and reading about where we were. And that's how you learn. Write to us, otw@2600.com. Again, stay tuned for Finn. Keep listening to WUSB. We'll be back next Tuesday, 6 p.m. And all kinds of cool programming will be airing between now and then.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.